This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. My special guest today is Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, who has degrees in civil engineering with a specialty in structural engineering, engineering mechanics, also known as applied physics, and materials engineering science, which are the specialization areas most relevant to understanding the phenomena that took place at the World Trade Center on September 11th. Before I turn to Judy, I want to mention an email I received addressed to me as "Hey, Wacky Conspiracy Guy," by a fellow who had been reading a newspaper and wrote me as follows. He said, "I was thinking of you recently when I read about the fire in Oakland, California. A horrible car crash in Oakland, California, quote, produced enough heat to cause the steel beams holding up a highway interchange to buckle and bolts holding the structure together to melt, as the newspaper said. Could this have been the work of our government too, you nutcase?" Well, I always appreciate receiving fan mail. This is from Jeter Hall of Fame at AOL.com. So I wrote back to Jeter Hall of Fame. I said, and of course, this wasn't a car crash, but it was a gasoline tanker. "The gasoline-based fires were reported to have burned around 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, but the jet fuel kerosene-based fires at the Twin Towers only burned around 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Moreover, the collapse of the section of the highway did not cause the collapse of the section of highway beneath it. The support columns did not collapse, and none of the concrete was pulverized. The melting point of steel is 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, and it will melt if that temperature is attained for a sufficient interval of time. But asphalt burns at 350 degrees Fahrenheit, so if the fire really occurred as reported, why is the asphalt intact? Why was it not consumed? Something is wrong with this report, but you've been taken in. The information about the asphalt, incidentally, wasn't mine, but derived from a conversation with Judy Wood, who also had Rosalie Grable, that the asphalt was intact when the metal was allegedly burned. And I think these two women were very insightful and perceptive here. As a professor of logic and critical thinking, of course, I teach my students that there are three ways in which analogies can be faulty. One is if there are more differences than similarities between the two things being compared. Second, if there are few but crucial differences, or third, if the argument is taken to be conclusive. In this case, of course, obviously there are more differences than similarities in the types of structures we're talking about, where there's a steel in common, but many other features that are not in common, including the support columns, the extent of exposure to the fire, the concrete pulverization, and all that. But moreover, there's a crucial difference insofar as the fires, ostensibly in Oakland, burned around 3,000 degrees, and the fires in the Twin Towers only burned around 500, as even the National Institute of Science and Technology has acknowledged. And of course, this fellow is basically assuming his argument is conclusive, so I would suggest in terms of committing the faulty analogy, his argument is flawed on all three counts. So it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the program Judy Wood. Judy, I want to thank you for having made that observation about asphalt. It seems to me there are a lot of efforts out there to try to counteract the growing interest in the 9/11 truth movement by offering examples that are really extremely seriously defective, but where even reporters on the scene may not realize what's going on.
Yes. it's something I wonder about. I don't know how hot that fire was.
Yes.
3,000 degrees I have trouble with, because if it's an open flame in air, it can't be 3,000 degrees.
Okay, good. So you're suggesting it might not even have been 2,800 degrees, not hot enough to melt fire. Where Rosalie, of course, was offering the possibility that it might have been some kind of microwave weapon that would, you know, have a draw attention to or focus on higher grade steel.
I don't know what it was, and I'm not willing to speculate at this point, but what I do have questions that, you know, why did they print in the paper that that fire burns at 3,000 degrees? And then another thing is, how long does it take the heat to get in? you have a heat transfer problem. And from the time, they reported the time that the vehicle crashed into the guardrail, what was it, 3:41?
42.
3:42, and the thing collapsed at 4:03 or 4:02, basically 20 minutes later.
20 minutes later.
Yeah, so in 20 minutes, how do you have, you know, this major catastrophe? How long does it take the heat to get into wherever it's getting?
How long does it take, you know, what was it, 3,800 or 6,800 gallons of gasoline to burn up?
Well, it's, yeah, gasoline burns pretty quickly, but more than that, if you have, if you're holding, well, how long does it take you to cook a big turkey?
Takes quite a few hours, four or five hours probably.
Why does it take so long depending on the mass of the turkey?
Yeah, because it's got the heat's got to be absorbed throughout the entire structure of the turkey, the whole thickness, yes.
Yeah, it takes a while for the heat to transfer inward.
Yes.
And that's the same case with a fire.
Of course, presumably steel is a better thermal conductor than turkey.
Correct. But 20 minutes is pretty quick.
But 20 minutes is pretty quick. So it looks pretty fishy. This guy and I have gone back several times, and he seems to think it's ridiculous, you know, that I should be noticing something that the reporters and the firemen didn't seem to notice. But I pointed out to him he oughtn't to feel so bad that I hadn't really noticed about the asphalt until an expert in the field pointed it out to me. And, of course, I met you. And then I discovered, of course, Rosalie also had put her finger on the same problem.
Well, I saw Rosalie's email, and she made an excellent point. Is around what she was drawing the analogy with is the toasted cars around the World Trade Center area. The cars were on fire. The steel was, you know, the engine blocks were burning. Paper was not, and neither was the pavement. That's what Rosalie had noticed, and that was a very good observation.
Good. Something else that's come to my attention is an email that is from Tom Bearden, who many of our listeners may know as an expert in the area of scalar weapons. And Tom Bearden was commenting on something from your site, from the Star Wars Beam page 3 site, about figures 36 to 39 showing the steel beam vaporizing into dust right in front of the camera operators. And Bearden writes that one presumes that a QP weapon could be tuned to only dissociate high-grade steel components into slit-sized particulate matter, 2 to 74 microns. This would explain the selectivity and why there was an attraction only to auto engine blocks, high-grade steel, say, ASTM 36 or above, as opposed to the whole car bodies. This, to me, Judy, was utterly fascinating because, you know, as we've looked at your toasted cars, we have observed how the engine block can be completely destroyed, and you have the front half of the vehicle a mess, and yet the back half looks brand new, and the gas tank's not even exploded.
Right. Yeah, it is an interesting phenomenon.
This QP, when he talks about a QP weapon, is that a quantum particle weapon, do you know? Or I'm not sure what he's talking about exactly.
I'm not familiar with his site, so I'm not sure what he's talking about.
Well, stand by, everyone. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. We're going to review new work she has on her website. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Professor Judy Wood, who is the most qualified scientist studying the events of 9/11 and who appears to be uniquely qualified to analyze the events at the World Trade Center. Her website at Dr. Judy Wood, that's drjudywood.com, is constantly under construction and being upgraded. And since Judy has made some major additions to the site recently, I thought it would be very useful for us to go through them with her. So, Judy, I'm really, really very pleased to have you back on again.
Well, thanks. First, I would like to make some comments about a topic I'd like to talk about interspersed in our conversation. And I have a link to the article on my homepage.
Okay.
Gatekeepers.
Gatekeepers, okay.
There's a beautiful comment in there. When folks first hear about what happened on 9/11. Someone will say, it sure looks like demolition, but I'm no physicist. And the remark is, most everyone seems to have forgotten that it doesn't require an expert to tell the difference between controlled demolition and a towering inferno.
Yeah, that's a pretty reasonable point. I mean, we've all seen so many cases of these resorts and casinos in Las Vegas being brought down by controlled demolition. I mean, the fact that you have the complete, abrupt, and total collapse, it's highly symmetric. All there tends to be a little kink where they've taken out one of the internal support columns so that it will implode or fall in toward its center, coming into its own footprint in approximately free-fall time. I don't know how anyone could mistake those features for features of anything else. I mean, they're so characteristic of controlled demolitions. And as I believe you've observed, not only does Building 7, for example, show all the features of a controlled demolition, but there are no features of a controlled demolition that it doesn't show.
Correct, but it's not necessarily a standard controlled demolition, but we all have the ability to look and to think. And if those who want to control the population don't want us to think, what do? They tell us we need to rely on a expert. And then, you know, people turn off their brain. Also, there's this herding into a single opinion, and you're not allowed to vary off of that. You're not allowed to have individual thought. You're not allowed to think.
Yeah.
And another quote they have in that article is, the smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but to allow very lively debate within that spectrum. You know, keep it in the corral. And I think it's important that we learn to get out of that corral and think for ourselves.
Yes. I mean, an example could be fixation with the thermite hypothesis and arguing intensely over, say, how much it might have taken without allowing discussion of any alternative possible explanations for what took place.
Correct. Or telling folks that somebody has the answer. Everyone looks for someone to give them the answer. And that is one misconception I'd like to clear up about our work here, is that we have not stated the answer. We have eliminated the impossible, starting out with looking at all of the data. And we have eliminated various things as being the primary cause based on X, Y, and Z of our various answers. And, of course, our critics like to pick at different issues and dismiss the data that they can't explain with what other theory. One of those is the toasted cars. The toasted cars are an interesting phenomenon. You look at them and they're not burned in typical ways. And that's, I think, the page you were thinking of, Sue, on in our document, the huge document, is the toasted car page, which is page 5. And then there's a shortcut link on my homepage to the Toasted Car Live. And the new section I've added, showing the toasted parking lot, which is a few blocks northwest of the World Trade Center complex. The first picture shows the toasted parking lot, well, before it's toasted. After the destruction of Tower 1, that parking lot has not caught fire. After the destruction of Tower 2, right as it's being destroyed, the parking lot is not on fire. Then the cloud rolls out from Tower 1, and the cars catch on fire. So you can see just before the cars catch on fire, they catch on fire, and then later you see the fire is out, and then, you know, weeks later, they're still sitting there rusting. And our critics say that the cars were towed. Well, it's not impossible. You know, maybe while the cars were flaming, they loaded them up on a flatbed truck, drove them around the block or towed them, and then brought them back to the exact same spot between our photographs. But I don't think that's very likely.
And there are, of course, features right there on the street that suggest that they, whatever happened to them there, and then they were maybe moved to the side of the street, but that was the distance they were adjusted.
The toasted parking lot. on Tosin Park lot, the cars stayed where they were before they caught fire. They burned, we have pictures of them burning in that place, and we have pictures of them after the fire's out. And there's plenty of empty spots in that parking lot that if there are other cars that they wanted to store someplace, why not store them there? Because a block or two north of there is where the loading docks were for the barges to haul them out of New York City. So it's kind of puzzling why someone would think that these cars would be towed over the FDR Drive on the opposite side of Manhattan just to be towed back. They're sitting there. But what is intriguing about these photographs is that you see the cars not on fire. There's paper between those cars and the World Trade Center complex, paper on the ground. And then you see the cars on fire. The paper still is not on fire. How did those cars catch fire?
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Special guest today is Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, and in my judgment, the single most highly qualified expert who's studying the events of 9/11, especially those at the World Trade Center in New York. Judy, you want to focus our attention on your website? What page should we be on?
Page 5.
Page 5 of Star Wars Beam Weapon.
Right. There's a link from the front page to the Tosin Car lot.
Yes. Yes, I see page 5, Tosin Cars, and where shall we continue?
There's a link at the top with the shortcuts.
Yeah.
To Tosin Car lot.
Okay. Yes, Tosin Parking Lot.
Tosin Parking Lot.
Okay, I'm there.
And as you go down, there, I tried to get them in chronological order. The first picture is right after Tower 2, the first tower to be destroyed, right after Tower 2 was destroyed. You can see the parking lot. It's not on fire.
We're talking about Toast 1, Figure Toast 1.
And Figure Toast 2A. These are temporary numbers until I get all the numbers in sequence.
Uh-huh.
And 2A is right when Tower 1 is being destroyed.
Okay, and you got a red circle around the parking lot.
Yes, and it's not on fire yet.
So the parking lot is actually, there's a barrier that Building 7 actually creates kind of a partial barrier in relation to the separation of the Twin Towers in that parking lot.
And Building 6 as well.
So Building 6 as well.
And the next picture, Toast 2B, that cloud has rolled out past the toasted lot and now it's on fire.
And the cloud has passed, and now it appears to be on fire, suggesting that there's something in the cloud that may be doing the damage.
Correct. And you go on to Toast 3 and Toast 4.
Yeah.
Toast 3, you see that the parking lot's really cooking, and there's still dust settling out of the air.
Yeah.
At Toast 4, the air is pretty well clear because we're upwind of the complex, and it's a sunny day. So most of the dust has blown south, and you see a clear view of the parking lot, and you have, several different fires going on. And
yeah.
Figure 5 is just north of the parking lot on West Street at that intersection. And you see that really cooking up a lot of smoke. And you can tell it's still morning from the shadows. Then the next series of pictures, 6, 7, and 8, are of that intersection, and you see a tremendous amount of paper between the WTC complex and that parking lot. And my point here is, why isn't that paper on fire? Why just the engine blocks and so forth are on fire, but not the grass? There's a grass lot there with some shrubs. Mound, and there's a lot of paper in the streets. And if you get down to figures 9A and 9B, that's right in that intersection. The papers are ankle deep.
Well, you've really added quite a few photographs here, Judy. You've been busy.
And figure 9A is one of my favorites, if not my favorite this week. here are the people who have been hiding when the towers are being destroyed, have come out of hiding, and they're looking with this gasp look on their face. Where did it go? Where is Tower One? It's not in the street. You see Building 6 in Figure Street 9A, you see Building 6 in the foreground, or in the background, but you see no tower behind it.
Yes.
And then Figure Street 9B, across the intersection, down the street at that parking lot that's on fire in the distance, and there's just paper between here and the parking lot.
Yeah, it all looks pretty much at ground level. There's a slight tapering upward on the right-hand side, as though there's a mountain or something there, but it's not very high.
In Figure 9B?
Yeah.
That's flat street. There's buildings and stuff there. That's just a shadow. That's north of the intersection. There were some fire trucks parked up that street.
Okay.
We saw the block north of there is Figure 5. It was stuff in the street. And as we continue down, we get other views of that parking lot, and you can watch the cars rust as the weeks go by. And then finally, they get towed away. Figure Toast 15, it's impressive how nice those wheels look. I don't know what they're made out of.
Oh, that is. It's like they've been cleaned, you know, like they had armor all put on them.
They're not steel.
And that's steel.
No.
No, that is not. Yeah, because I think those are aluminum, actually.
So why we have something that's happening different to the vehicles and those wheels. They're different materials.
Yeah.
We have different activities.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very interesting observation. They got the steel and the chassis steel. You know, what Tom Bearden was observing, of course, is the chassis steel is a much lower quality steel than the engine blocks, which are very high quality steel. And here, of course, it looks like these are sort of residual effects because they're from the cloud passing over them rather than direct effects them. These seem to be secondary effects. Would you agree of whatever it was that, has caused the pulverization?
No, I'm not in total agreement because I think what is happening, we need to look at the data. The data is, it appears that the did this to the cars. What was in the clouds that did that?
What was in the clouds that did it, yes.
It was not heat.
Yes.
The paper would have burned if it was the heat that did that.
Could it be anything acidic, remotely acidic, you know? I mean, I gather there was a rather acrid smell, like a transformer, you know, burning from an electric train in the atmosphere. I've got some reports like that. I'm looking, hoping to get more.
Right, and yes, we welcome people who smelled something that day to contact us, because there does seem to be a trend of people reporting transformer-like smell. But if you burn something in the air, I think of that being, the electric train used as a child, you smell that transformer smell. That is an interesting sort of uniform reporting, and we would love to have some observers of that contact us.
I assume in Figure Toast 14, that very first vehicle on the right looks like it's just been parked there. That looks like a new vehicle that wasn't exposed to the dust cloud.
And maybe they're the ones taking some pictures walking around.
Yeah.
But there's various levels of damage. It may have been there. After all, look at the car being towed. It doesn't look too bad.
Right. Mangled on the top.
Right. It was very selective what was hit. And it rusted very quickly, it appears.
Yeah, because this is only, what, a days later? Or is it a week later? How quickly was it? Do we know?
We said the Figure Toast 12 was taken on the 23rd.
Fascinating stuff. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. My special guest today is Dr. Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, who has degrees in civil engineering with a focus on structural engineering and engineering mechanics, also known as applied physics, and in materials engineering science. She is the scientist I consider to be the best qualified in the 9/11 research community to study the events of 9/11, in particular with regard to the World Trade Center. And today we're going through her website, which is constantly being updated, and she's taking us through an inventory of a lot of new photographs and other materials she's added to the site. Where should we continue, Judy?
Well, I think we pretty much finished the toasted car issue. I'm sure a lot of people have seen the toasted cars on FDR Drive, which have similar things. I think the important thing is to realize there's a distance between the toasted cars and the World Trade Center complex, and there's things in between that aren't burned. Also, it's important in looking at the data to realize that when you have, you see this volcano-like activity, like the bubbler picture, there's other pictures that show this, you see things flying out. The steel is trailing dust, the aluminum is not, which is an interesting detail to notice.
The steel is trailing dust and the aluminum is not. You know, if you flip up to the top of the page, Judy, the fire truck phenomena you have there, like 66E, where the front of the fire truck is really essentially gone, and the back of the fire truck is more or less intact, then you confront issues like what could have done this damage to the front. I had a recent debate in New York with someone who was trying to defend the official account, and they said it was obvious the front of the cab had been crushed by falling debris. But when you look at this photograph, say 66E, it's pretty obvious there's some kind of wilting and some weird phenomenon there, and I don't see any massive debris that could have brought about this phenomenon.
Yeah, why did they carefully lift just the debris off? But the debris doesn't, you don't see any cut-out shape of the debris. You just see the wilted front end. But the picture directly above that, which is called, fire truck.
Yes.
You can have a melted tire on the pavement.
Yeah, that's a good point. Where was the engine in this fire truck, the figure fire truck? Do we know?
I assume it was in the front.
In the front, to the right, then, to the right side. So it's completely destroyed, it would appear.
It's just missing.
This is the one beside figure hazmat. Seems to be, engine seems to be completely destroyed.
And it has random, holes in the side. Now, this was parked right out in front of Building 6 on West Street. If you move just to the right of that picture and move backward, that's where Tower 1 is. So it's close to the complex. But notice there's no beams in the street there.
No beams, right. As in falling steel from the building that would have caused damage if that hypothesis were true. And then, of course, you got the New York Police Department vehicle where the front is all ablaze, and then the rest of the vehicle looks perfectly normal.
And the paper sitting next to it isn't burning.
That is so odd. So very, very odd. The selectivity here of what is affected and what isn't has to be the most important clue as to what we're dealing with, do you not think?
Yes. I'm not going to weigh out which detail is the most important, but it is a very important detail. So if someone's going to come up with the answer, it needs to account for all of these details.
Yes, yes.
In the rush to get to an answer.
Yes. And I worry terribly that, the simple answers are going to be so appealing because they obviate the necessity to think things through. I mean, once you're convinced, say, that thermate was responsible, you don't even have to think about the melting point of steel or the highest temperature a jet-based fuel fire can attain or the amount of time in which the destruction of the towers took place. And you can get very casual in talking about the difference between pulverization of the buildings and collapse, which is, of course, a huge blunder conceptually because as even the NIST essentially concedes, I mean, when those top sections are turning to powder, there's nothing there in terms of mass to put pressure on the lower floors, which, of course, have an absorptive capacity that hasn't been overcome by the mass of material above it, but when it's turned to dust, it doesn't even count.
Right. It can't have any kind of impact on things if it's dust.
Extraordinarily minimal gravitational attraction on dust particles.
Right.
Their mass is so minuscule. Where should we go from here, Judy?
All right. From the front page, there's another article I have.
When you say front page, you mean page one, or?
No, from my homepage.
Oh, homepage. Go to homepage.
Another link that takes us to do sponsors and Department of Defense contractors.
Okay, where do I find those shortcuts again?
It's in the news section under articles. It's for today's show. I have it listed, 2 May.
Okay, news section, yeah.
And then on the right side, I have articles listed that I have links to for today's show.
Okay, do sponsors and Department of Defense contractors?
Yes.
That's where we're going?
Yep.
Okay. There, I'm there.
And there's a long list of folks who support directed energy weapons.
Wow. Lockheed Martin, a lot of these companies, I don't know by their acronyms, but you got a lot, Boeing, CSA Engineering, Denergy Solutions, GTRI, Gatec, Hamilton, Sund, Strand, ITEA, Jonatron, Lockheed Martin again, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Sparta, Systems.Textron, a lot of stuff here, Judy. I mean, there are about 24, I guess.
Well, we've been commenting about that we need to take into account articles of the data, is that whatever happened is selective based on materials. It has a particular effect. And also, we believe there's a tremendous amount of energy involved. So you have energy that's directed, and I sure would call this a weapon. So that's why I use the term directed energy weapon. And on page 7, I have a long list of what we're considering, or what we have not eliminated.
Yeah,
it's a very long list.
Well, and I notice you have a lot of examples of these types of weapons here on this very page. Scrolling down,
we don't know which of these they used. They could have used, but one thing is clear: these folks understand these items.
Yeah, they know what's going on. The people in the military-industrial complex, but I think, people who are, physicists and all that, wouldn't necessarily know unless, of course, they've been exposed to the development of some of these weapons, techniques, and procedures in the course of their own research.
Well, the folks who developed these may not have realized what it was going to be used for.
Yes.
And now I'm sure that they realize it. They're in a pretty difficult position internally. If they speak out, they probably fear what might happen. But that's why at the top of the page I have a whistleblower link.
Yes.
For information on being a whistleblower and what your rights are.
I like that.
This is a very difficult issue because we see that there's things that have been developed. These are real photographs.
Yeah. I think those who are skeptical about the existence of lasers, masers, plasmoids, all that, need to take a good look at the array of weapons on this page. This, today, my special guest, Judy Wood. I'm your host, Jim Fetzer. This is the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back. My special guest today, Dr. Judy Wood, a former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University. She has degrees in civil engineering with a focus in structural engineering, engineering mechanics, which is also known as applied physics, and materials engineering science, and is, in my judgment, the single most qualified scientist who is studying the events of 9/11, in particular what occurred at the World Trade Center. Judy, during the news flash, of course, we just heard that Governor Schwarzenegger is promoting the reconstruction of that section of the highway that was damaged by this massive fire. And in the meanwhile, I have printed out an article that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle. Tanker fire destroys part of MacArthur Maze. Two freeways closed near Bay Bridge. I should know it better than to disagree with you about even a minor matter, because it points out that the crash actually occurred at 3:41, not 3:42, as I suggested. I want to read just a couple parts of this where the latter paragraphs are particularly interesting. The single vehicle crash occurred on the lower roadway when the tanker loaded with 8,600 gallons of unleaded gasoline and heading from a refinery in Biencia to a gas station on Hegerberger Road in Oakland hit a guardrail at 341. Engineers said the steel green frame of I-580 overpass and the bolts holding the frame together began to melt and bend in the intense heat, and that movement pulled the roadbed off its supports. Now, this is the part that's particularly interesting. Isaac Rodriguez, a 53-year-old sanitation supervisor who works the graveyard shift at East Bay Municipal Utility District Sewage Treatment Plant, said his supervisor called him about 3:45 a.m. and told him to leave work because of a nearby explosion. Rodriguez went outside with a coworker and saw the I-880 connector about 50 feet above him engulfed in fire with flames leaping up to the I-580 connector above that. It was massive, Rodriguez said. I saw movement and there was a man up there. I started talking to the guy. Are you the truck driver? Yes, he said. I am burned. I got out as soon as I could. The driver seemed disoriented. I looked at one time he was walking toward the truck again. I believe he was in shock, Rodriguez said. Rodriguez said he regretted not thinking to send a vehicle up to get the injured man. He said a coworker stood for some 40 minutes watching the freeway burn. He and a coworker stood. It looked like a big slab of plastic because it was melted. It's made of steel and concrete, and it was bent at both angles of the pillar. It really looked fake. It was an event last night that I'm not going to forget for a long time. It was incredible because it was a roar. No sign of the truck remains at the scene. One Caltrans worker there early this morning held up his thumb and forefinger an inch apart to describe how big the tanker is now. What do you make of that, Judy? The tanker's reduced to an inch thick?
Well, that's what somebody said in a newspaper article. I'm skeptical. That I think there's a lot of questions that need to be answered.
Yeah, this is all pretty bizarre.
Rosalie Grable, Web Ferry?
Yeah.
Apparently found some pictures showing that the truck was burning white hot. So one has to wonder what could cause such heat, enormous heat, from a fire in atmospheric pressure.
In other words, it could be that the truck itself was a part of the target, because the truck maybe had fairly high-grade steel, and perhaps this was a selective weapon, you know, that focused on high-grade steel, such as the bolts and the connectors, and didn't affect the asphalt. That could be part of why it was so intense and why the truck was so massively destroyed.
We need to be careful not to be in a rush to get to the answer, but in the data. And the data, so far, doesn't agree with a little truck fire.
Yeah.
That's what I'm questioning. I'm just looking at inconsistencies with that story. I want to know why a truck burns at such enormous temperatures, but also why in just 20 minutes' time it's enough to fail something. We have a huge heat transfer problem.
Yes.
When you heat up one part, it takes a while for the heat to get elsewhere. Where was the heat applied? Directly to some bolts, and the whole thing just hanging on one or two bolts? It doesn't seem like a very reasonable design.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Okay, well, let's return to your website. Where should we go now?
Well, we're discussing this due contractors.
Right. Directed Energy Weapon Sponsors and Department of Defense Contractors.
And yes, those who support it. And I have various, other articles listed there as well. Like at the bottom of that, the list of links to the different contracts. I also have a listing of a book that seems quite interesting, Laser Beam Propagation Through Random Media.
Yes.
Now, I'm not saying, what kind of a wavelengths or what the gizmo was they used. It was just involved high energy.
Yeah.
It could be directed.
Yeah.
And it was a weapon.
Notice the first edition of that book was 1998. The second, 2005.
It's interesting that the author said that they had to remove various sections and now are putting them back in.
They had to remove various sections, and now they're putting them back in. So, in other words, the second, before the first edition, and now they're putting them back in the second, or before the second edition, now they're putting them back in the third.
No. The first edition, before it came out, they had to remove sections.
They were being censored. Yeah. Okay.
And now they put those sections back.
That's interesting. I'd be fascinated if some of those sections pertain to the kinds of weaponry that could have been used at the World Trade Center.
I'd like to point out, you know, with the various weapons that we show down further down that page, I mean, there's plenty of stuff there to show something is possible for them to have used.
Yeah.
We don't need to know what it is. The full range of these weapons is classified information, so we make no limits or distinction of categories within the realm of high-energy weapons.
Yes.
And doing so would imply specific knowledge of all that's available, and we have no access to that information.
Yes.
And we yes. do the same.
Yes. This is where, you know, the undue burden of proof and the more exact, you know, the too exacting answers to questions when you're talking about broad categories of hypotheses, which, of course, was what Greg Jenkins did in his hit interview with you after I gave a talk at the National Press Club on 10 January.
Right, with an agenda in mind. And his agenda was to collect a video that he could manipulate, but...
Yes.
And present as he wished, which is sort of interesting that it wasn't about finding out the truth.
Yes, and it's fascinating to me that when you read the transcript of your exchange, it's very clear that you were, you know, drawing distinctions and making intellectual moves that were completely appropriate. And yet when you watch it, I mean, somehow his demeanor conveys the impression that, you know, he's perplexed by what you're doing, when I think a perfectly reasonable understanding makes it perfectly intelligible.
Correct. We make no distinction of the different categories of what was used, and you know we haven't we've just seen what we've eliminated. There's no gravitational collapse, no gravity-driven quote collapse. That is one thing we do state, but we don't know if it involves photoluminescence or antimatter weapons or scalar weapons or HARP or nuclear directed energy weapons. Conventional directed energy weapons, improvised directed energy weapons. I have to laugh at that one. There were some folks who gathered together a whole bunch of microwave ovens, like you know, from a junkyard.
Yeah.
Put them all together in series or parallel and made a directed energy weapon out of them.
Fascinating stuff. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. Today, my special guest is Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, and we're discussing recent additions to her website, which can be accessed at drjudywood.com. And in this case, we're looking at a page related to directed energy weapon contractors. Judy, pick up wherever.
Yes, many people may not be in front of their computers or in front of the page. So let me describe some of what is here. For example, there's a PowerPoint presentation given by Raytheon, and the PDF file link is provided, where they show that they have this blimp type thing that can fly at the upper edge of the low Earth orbit.
Yes.
And they note that it's above radar detection.
Yes.
If you paint that thing sky blue, it's going to be
invisible to the eye from the ground.
Correct. And you can mount various things on there. There's something, a LEOS, produced by Boeing that has various directed energy weapons mounted on it. It's just that it hangs on strings.
Look at that one for figure three, that aerostat. That looks like that's got a huge bulge, you know, it's like a pregnant blimp, and I presume that's where the weapons are located.
Well, something else is located down there, but they also have various, if you click on the picture, you get a big picture of it, and you can see that there's various little things that can hang off of it.
Yeah.
Cameras. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right in front. I see it, yeah.
Such
devices are mounted there.
Right. It's who knows what they use it for, but we know that if they're advertising that it can hang out at the upper edge of low Earth orbit and not be detectable by radar.
Yeah.
And that they can hang stuff off of it.
You know, I wonder, Judy, at the incredible lack of imagination of those who want to restrict the range of hypotheses under consideration to pedestrian alternatives like dynamite or RDX or HDX or even thermite and thermate, which you can buy on eBay. I mean, it's ridiculous. The effects are so overwhelming and inconsistent with the mere use of conventional explosives. I just can't understand why, you know, anyone would resist exploring the full range of alternative hypotheses, which is an indispensable aspect of scientific reasoning. To artificially contract the range of hypotheses under consideration means that as you proceed to adapt the hypotheses to the evidence, you, even when you come up with the hypothesis seems to provide the best explanation, you may in fact have excluded the true hypothesis already because it wasn't included in your original set.
Correct. But I think it's also important to just notice what kind of things your tax dollars are going to support. These are our tax dollars at work here.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, you know, the American taxpayer is paying for weapons the existence of which they do not know, some of which may be used to kill American taxpayers. I mean, that's quite a nasty situation.
It's just, the next section, Lockheed Martin, they're also involved in the ABL, which is the Airborne Laser Weapon System. They mount this huge gizmo on the front of a Boeing 747.
Yeah.
And if you go down to the Boeing section below that, you get a lot more pictures of it, of the thing actually flying. And there's some videos at the bottom of that section that show the thing in operation, making its beam change angles and reorient. You can have a flyby shooting. It gives it a lot more meaning.
This is scary stuff, Judy. Very, very scary stuff.
These videos look like infomercials with, you know, hip music on them. As though, you know, these beam weapons are your friends.
Well, they are to the Department of Defense. See, I mean, these are the clever ways in which the contractors present their wares to those who they want to buy them.
And I haven't expanded much on the Northrop Grumman section, but we know they're using those in Iraq. I remember on page 7, I had that, the video of the press conference with Rumsfeld.
Right. And where they talked about the vehicle that just wilted like a wet cloth.
Correct. And there's a lot of similarities between what we see in Iraq and what we saw in New York City on 9/11. But this, those are made by Northrop Grumman. There's a whole lot of different manufacturers of various things. And I also have an article section I'm starting to build up with various articles on directed energy weapons, as well as the mainstream, what the mainstream is saying at the same time. So there's a, you know, they have a different way. It's like it's a totally different time period when it's the same time period. When they talk about, oh, it's 40 years in the future, when here's proof of it already in existence.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the whole idea is to conceal that these things are around so they can use them, and you can't figure out what in the world's going on. I mean, I found that already in the case of the 2002 crash that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone, that they appeared to be using a very simple form of directed energy device that simply overwhelmed the electrical system, caused the solenoids, these electrical switches that control the pitch of the props, to put them on idle, which inevitably brought about the crash of the plane. Then there was a weird, intense fire of the fuselage, even though the wings broke off, and the wings were the principal reserve for the fuel. The tail broke off, but the fuselage burned intensely for 7 hours and reduced the contents to charcoal, so they only found the bodies the next day when they were looking for a black box.
Did they find a black box?
They didn't. Now, it's interesting because they spent a day and a half looking for one, which presumably they would not have done unless they actually believed there was one, but later concluded that there had never been one.
Or they found it and it disappeared.
The FBI was Johnny on the spot. I mean, the whole thing had a lot of mysterious aspects to it that were incredibly suspicious, and our analysis suggests it was a deliberate takedown of a outspoken senator who was a great pain in the side of the Bush administration and whom they had targeted for political elimination, and it wasn't going to happen.
And it also sends a message to others who choose not to run.
That's absolutely right. Judy, thank you so much for being on today. I look forward to our further conversation today. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Dr. Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, who is our best qualified scientist looking at the issues of 9/11 related to the World Trade Center. And Judy, I think you want to talk about some of these weapons we're looking at on your page devoted to directed energy weapon sponsors and DOD contractors.
Correct, and we're not promoting any particular one, but I think it's important that taxpayers know where their money is being spent.
I've been very disillusioned with everyone, you know, who wants to leap on the idea that the possible source of energy could have been space-based. I mean, that includes aircraft, of course, but also there are many ground-based weapons. You've got these dirigibles and so forth. I mean, the possibilities are quite extensive, and it's just shocking to me how the use of attempts to ridicule serious hypotheses takes place so effortlessly, it seems, in this particular research community.
It goes back to that quote I read you at the beginning about trying to control public opinion.
Yeah, keep the debate intense within a very narrow range of options.
Right, and keep people from thinking for themselves.
Yeah, so we've seen an awful lot of that. I mean, the very idea of using phrase like death ray or space beam seems to me to attempt to just sabotage the very idea of taking seriously alternative hypotheses, no matter how much they may be required by the hard evidence that you've assembled on your website.
Or ray beams knocking down the towers when I think pretty much everyone knows that the towers didn't go down, they went up.
That's right, they were pulverized. There was not a collapse, it was a destruction. I was in a debate in New York where the host was saying he thought he must have misunderstood when I said that describing what happened as a collapse was wrong and that the proper term was destruction. He thought it should have been the other way around, but of course destruction is compatible with many modes of devastation, including pulverization or vaporization or collapse. Collapse is one very specific form of destruction that is not justified as a description of what happened here.
Correct, and you know, the towers were there, and then they went away.
Creating millions of cubic yards of dust that completely enveloped lower Manhattan and moved out to sea.
But it's important also to note that people talk about our theory or our hypothesis or our speculation. I don't believe we've had any speculation. We have eliminated the impossible. And there's a wide range of what is left.
Well, you see, we're in this third stage of scientific reasoning. The first stage is puzzlement. We have this puzzling phenomenon, including all the oddities we're also familiar with, 6543, blah, blah, blah. Then we have this stage of speculation, which means advancing alternative possible explanations, which could be in the natural disaster category, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, or the conventional explanations, dynamite, RDX, thermite, thermate, or, of course, the government's hypothesis that it was done by the impact of the planes and the jet-based fuel fires caused this field to weaken and then a collapse to come about. And then we have the non-conventional. I mean, I think there's no doubt that none of the hypotheses or approaches that fall into the natural or conventional or official account categories can possibly explain the data.
Correct, and that does not mean that it didn't happen.
Doesn't mean it didn't happen. I agree. I mean, you have this massive pulverization of the buildings, and every time I watch footage of those buildings turning to dust, it's just awe-inspiring, Judy, the amount of energy that had to be involved in bringing about these effects. They are fantastic.
It's a tremendous amount. We don't know the mechanism, exactly how it was done, but we know it had to have been done. There had to be a mechanism that did this, and all of the well-known weapons cannot explain the data that we have.
Exactly.
And it has to be something that we do not know about. Yes.
Right, it has to be something relatively unfamiliar, but all these classified weapons programs, most of which emerged out of the Star Wars research project initiated by Ronald Reagan, seem to fall into that category.
Correct. It's what did they do for so many years? Of course, they tell you that nothing worked, and that's why they threw more and more dollars at it. Trillions? Who knows how many dollars?
Oh God, it has to be in the trillion-dollar category. I have no doubt.
So what did they develop in there that we don't know about?
Yeah. And remember, they're driven by this desire for full-spectrum dominance, not only controlling land, sea, and air, but also space. So, I mean, if that's the objective, is to control the world by domination of through the militarization of space, and Bob Bowman, who used to direct the Star Wars program under two presidents, has recently acknowledged that the whole business was set up to be an offensive weapon system, not defensive, even though it was marketed that way, seems to me to provide dramatic confirmation that what was going on here, what has been going on here, what continues to go on here, is the development of weapons that can be used for their massive destructive potential on targets on Earth.
Yes, and how quickly they can disappear something.
That's right.
Or take out all of the enemy's defenses before you attack them.
Right, I was reading a description recently of some of these weapons that were said they could take out dams, which are rather formidable structures, in seconds. Taking out dams in seconds.
Correct, or cause earthquakes in the region of a dam. Yeah, make it look natural.
Yeah, you wonder how much of what goes on these days in the way of tsunamis, for example, may not have been contrived by the American government for who knows what reason.
One thing of concern here is that we need to remember people who designed these various weapons probably designed them thinking they were for beneficial purposes, like deflecting a meteor heading towards the Earth.
Yes. 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 That's a great point, right? You're inspired by the noble causes, the idea that, you know, these weapons could be used to save humanity when in fact they're actually going to be used to destroy large numbers of people and dominate the planet.
And they saw what happened on 9/11. They know. And we would like to hear from them. They have rights. There's whistleblower rights, and that information is at the top of the page, the link to a special whistleblower page. And it's an uncomfortable position to be in, to realize, you know something to do with how this was developed, how this came to be.
Here's a nice little item. Airborne laser progress continues as Northrop Grumman runs full-power COIL test, delivers beacon illuminator laser, Redondo Beach, California, January 4th, 2006. Laser systems built by Northrop Grumman Corporation for the Missile Defense Agency's airborne laser continue to post solid progress with the completion of power and duration testing of the megawatt-class chemical laser and delivery of the beacon illuminator laser. The chemical oxygen iodine laser, COIL, is the world's most powerful directed energy weapon built for an airborne environment. The BILL, a high-power solid-state laser, is essential to ABL, that's airborne laser, agency airborne laser, beam control, fire control system that steers coils beam as it propagates toward a target at 186,000 miles per second, the speed of light.
Page are you on?
I'm right below the photograph of the advanced tactical laser, the green with the red streak coming out of it, you know, the red laser image. I'm right above the bottom where you had all the icons for, they look like, a lot of them like credit cards, but there's a bunch of, you know, little photographs.
Yeah.
Shortly above it. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Returning to the final segment with my special guest, Dr. Judy Wood, former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson. Judy, why don't you direct our attention where you think it'll do the most good, but I must say how grateful I am to have you on and for you to clarify directly from you that you have not committed yourself to any specific form of energy weapon, but rather something in this broad class of weapons that can, or devices that can bring about the kinds of effects that we observed at the World Trade Center during its devastation, because I'm quite convinced that none of the conventional explanations, much less the government's official account, can explain them either in their breadth or their depth or their particularity.
Correct. There's nothing conventional about what we saw happen. In 10 seconds, a 110-story building disappeared. That's pretty incredible. What happens if they turned up the knob a little bit too high on that? it's a bit scary, a bit concerning. At the bottom of this due sponsors and contractors page, I have a link to the articles page, which I've just started. That's why I was curious before when I asked what you were reading from. I thought
yeah.
I was reading from one of those articles, because there's a great deal of articles that are there already, but I'll be adding to them.
Did you discover where I was reading from? Right above airborne laser tests on target, right above the U.S. Air Force photo by Captain Jay Orson of the big plane with a funny knob?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of literature available out there if one just looks. And there's an excellent group, the Federation of American Scientists, FAS.org, who are trying to keep weapons out of space, and they seem quite concerned about what's going on as well, and perhaps we can get some help from those folks, and they have wonderful resources on their site as well.
Yeah.
It isn't about who has what answer and who can do what to whom when, and it's about we have a serious issue here of what is capable of happening to our planet, to our civilization, and that's what we should all be concerned about.
Yes. Yes, 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 absolutely right. I mean, you know, the pollution of the planet, all these things, I mean, we're going to destroy ourselves one way or another, I have no doubt.
And this one article that I saw on, and it's on my page about antimatter weapons?
Yeah.
Where the last quote in the article is, I think we need to get off this planet because I'm afraid we're going to destroy it.
Yeah, yeah.
Go to, but I think it's going to be, it could easily be destroyed faster than we can figure out how to live elsewhere.
Judy, I would like to take this opportunity to invite you to explain to persons who want to understand where you're coming from. I mean, you and I and Morgan Reynolds have been the targets of so many attacks on such flimsy and ill-conceived grounds. I just would like to give you the opportunity to address some of your critics and to try to, you know, help them to understand why they oughtn't to be taken in by phrases like death rays or space beams.
The terms, derogatory terms such as that are designed to control one's thinking. And thinking people are capable of thinking for themselves. They're capable of understanding basics. So if someone is telling you how to think or trying to control the breadth of which you are thinking or exploring, you should ask yourself, is that what you want to do? Do you want to be controlled? And,
yeah.
And terms like, ray beams knocking down the towers, that is not an intelligent way to approach the problem. Instead, to look at what the data is. Or let's say we have a video of Judy Wood picking her nose, so therefore anything she says is ridiculous. What kind of absurd reasoning is that?
Mm-hmm.
And why is that the most important thing? Does somebody not want you to look at the data? Let's go look at the data and think for ourselves.
Well, it's ridiculous that anyone who is familiar with the nature of science should want to ignore hypotheses or relevant evidence. I mean, that is such a violation of the most basic principle known as the requirement of total evidence, which insists that in the search for truth, you have to base your reasoning on all of the available relevant evidence, where evidence is relevant when its truth or falsity or presence or absence makes a difference to the truth or falsity of the conclusion. And here, when we're talking about these massive effects, if you never even get to the point of describing everything you got to explain, you're going to come up with a partial and incomplete account at best.
For example, we need to think, what's the difference between urban legend, supporting evidence, and proven fact? For example, molten metal. Have we seen evidence, supporting evidence of molten metal? Is it proven fact, or is it just urban legend? How about the enormous heat? I think we've all seen the picture of the fellow running down the street with the clouds chasing him from behind. And there's a bunch of people on the street running from the clouds. We didn't see a bunch of cooked bodies when the cloud passed. So was there all this tremendous heat? And we saw people emerging from their holes they're hiding in right after the towers were destroyed. They were not overheating. They still had their jackets on. So do we have any evidence of enormous heat? And was the heat, you know, the primary thing? What things occurred that did not produce heat?
Yeah, something that intrigued me greatly about your observation regarding some of the debris that is stored in Hangar 17 at JFK was how some of those asteroids included rebar, that the rebar was not melted, and therefore what we're looking at might be the result of intense pressure, but not necessarily great heat. On the other hand, some of those massive support columns that were bent like limp spaghetti suggested that there had to be the presence of massive heat. So I think you're really talking about diverse effects of different kinds of causes.
We can't assume that it was bent because of heat. It could have been bent because of some other activity. Some other process could have altered the material. We can't just assume it was heat. For example, if there's something that could happen in the atmosphere around the beam that would cause it to suddenly weaken, then it would deform. It wouldn't necessarily be heat.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that might change the chemical structure.
Aha. Yeah, this is something I really need to think more about, Judy. Oh, that's the character of the chemical lasers. You know, I mentioned occasionally how others have brought up the idea of directed energy weapons, and they haven't been blackballed for that, including Webster Tarpley, for example, in Synthetic Terror. He talks about the possible use of directed energy in destroying the World Trade Center, in particular the Twin Towers, and even cites the work of Jim Hoffman. And elsewhere, he talks about the possible use of a chemical laser to take down a plane in Pennsylvania. And I really don't understand the selective criticism of you for discussing hypotheses that others have raised without also receiving equal criticism.
Somebody's afraid to go there.
Well, let me just thank you again for coming on, Judy Wood. I look forward to bringing you back. I think it's tremendous, the work you're doing, and hope others will visit your website. This has been a great pleasure. Thank you all for listening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo.
Thanks.
Thank you.